Longhorn Nation. He's going for the corner. He's got it. Texas is the foot kicker. The kicker comes through.
We're back.
Hello, all, and welcome to another episode of the Fire Tom Herman Podcast, your overreactionary Texas Longhorns football fan podcast. My name is Josh, and my co-host is Noah, and today we're talking about the Alamo Bowl, the hiring of Mike Yurcich as the new offensive coordinator, and all the other coaching staff changes we're expecting this offseason. Noah, I know from our last podcast we were basically on the same page for our expectations going into the bowl game, but damn, it's always nice to be wrong when we're feeling pessimistic.
Yeah, it is. I wish it happened a little bit more often, honestly. But no, it was a great game. I was able to go to it, and it was definitely a lot more fun putting on a 28-point beatdown rather than ending the season with a loss.
Yeah, I mean, going into it, I would have said just with our coaching staff being basically half of a coaching staff, that I was anticipating closer to a 28-point win for Utah. But I mean, Tom Herman, against all odds, sort of proved the thing that's made him made him such a hot commodity was that he does get his teams to execute in those big moments, and he continues to be perfect in bowl games. And this is 2 years in a row where we've walked in and a lot of people haven't given us a chance, and a lot of our own fans, us included, haven't really given us a chance. And we've gone out there and put together a solid game. I don't think there's been a bowl game really for Tom Herman where into the second half the game felt well in hand for his team.
It really makes you you kind of think about what happens during the season. But yeah, I mean, everybody had to have liked everything that they saw from this game. We won all three phases, offense, defense, special teams, and I don't really think it was particularly close in anything. Like, I don't think there's anything that you could even argue that Utah did better than we did.
Yeah, I mean, Bill Connolly posts after games, he'll post his sort of advanced breakdown to sort of reflect how close the game was. Like, for example, for the Liberty Bowl for Navy versus Kansas State, that was a 7-point game, but according to his advanced analytics, Navy should have won that game nearly 80% of the time. If everything else stayed equal as far as yardage, their explosiveness, all of that, really, Navy sort of blew out Kansas State and still nearly lost to Kansas State. But that was a game where they should have won about 80% of the time. For us, it was a solid 100. It wasn't even like there's a chance that somehow Utah pulls this off. No. I mean, we were so dominant that even Connolly's stats liked us.
And that's definitely a rarity. But yeah, it's definitely one of those things where I like it, because last year with Georgia, it's like, oh, they didn't want to be there. But like this time, it's like, okay, maybe Utah was a little disappointed, but that doesn't translate to 28 points. Neither does it being basically a home game. Like, at least 80% of the stadium had to have been Texas fans. But so it's one of those things where, like, they can complain about the refs, they can complain about the crowd, they can complain about not being in the playoffs, but none of those things account for 28 points and just the pure domination that actually took place on the field.
Yeah, I mean, there's a bunch of little things, and yeah, they might have come out a little bit unfocused. But, I mean, even if it was just these two teams straight up, the fact that we did not have half of our coaching staff, and then on top of that, Tom Herman talked in the postgame presser, going into bowl games, you get 15 extra practices. You can practice up to 15 total times. And at least from what I understood, I always thought every team actually took advantage of all 15. Especially when there's down years, fans will talk about how those 15 practices are going to be huge for helping develop for the next season. Tom Herman said we only practiced 8 times. During when we could have practiced 15 times.
That was
we had
really
half
weird.
Of a coaching staff. We had half our coaching staff coaching half as much as they were allotted to coach for, and we still blew Utah out by 28.
It was weird because Herman has said that exact same thing about the importance of the bowl practices. Like in 2017, I mean, maybe it's just that's all that we had to. That's the only way that he could positively spin a 6-6 season, you know, but I remember him talking about how important those 15 practices were. So it is weird, but I'm sure that he was preoccupied with other things like finding coordinators. So I'll kind of excuse it, but
I mean, I'm not upset. It worked, clearly. But I just thought that was odd that all of these factors, it seemed like we were the team phoning it in when you look at it like that. We don't have a coaching staff, and we don't practice half the time that we're allowed to practice. It seems like we're the ones who have sort of thrown in the towel, and the exact opposite is what came out.
Yeah, that's true. So, I mean, I don't think anybody can really explain Texas football. I don't even know why we try, but... Yeah, it's almost like that's not what happened. Of course, we're going to win by 28.
Yeah, it's like golfing. It doesn't matter. It seems like you can do everything right or everything wrong, and the ball's just going to go where the ball wants to go. There's only so much control you can pretend to have over it. Otherwise, it's just a clusterfuck. Who knows what's happening? But let's get into the Alamo Bowl a little bit. The Alamo Bowl doesn't do it like the Sugar Bowl last year only had one MVP. Alamo Bowl has two. They do one on the offensive side, one on the defensive side. And with us winning, offensive MVP, as you would figure, just sort of as being the vocal leader, Sam Ehlinger wins offensive MVP, more than 200 yards passing, three touchdowns, one interception that really ends up going down is like the most effective short arm punt of all time. He also added another 73 yards on the ground with another touchdown. And then Joseph Osai absolutely went crazy in this game. The game I think that we saw from him against Georgia. He had a huge impact against Georgia. He led the team in tackles, and he really just built on that bowl game performance. So I think if you're a guy like Chris Ash, you see that you have this kid who is a sophomore right now, is going to be a junior for you next year. And if you're Chris Ash watching from the stands, you're just going, I have to make this kid the focal point in my defense next year, right?
You would think so. But yeah, that was Osai's first sack since September.
Yeah, and that really just goes to show how misused he was. I mean, Todd Orlando had a habit of almost playing him in like Rover and
nickel. He was our nickel.
Sometimes nickelback, yeah. So it shows that, I mean, that's got to be one of those things where if you're Tom Herman, you look at that and you go, this dude could have been terrorizing quarterbacks all year, and this is what my previous defensive coordinator... It's got to make you feel good if you're Tom Herman. You go, okay, there's no sort of whatever the opposite of buyer's remorse is. There's no, is this the right decision? You look at it and go, yeah. He needed to go if we could not utilize a guy who's this good properly.
Yeah. I mean, it's the DC's job to maximize talent that he has. And I think that this is a pretty clear example of a case where that didn't happen all season long.
Yeah, and Herman talked about it after Chris Ash got hired. Someone asked a question about the four-man front with Chris Ash, whether or not we had the personnel to fit Ash's preferred scheme. And Herman said it doesn't matter. You tailor your scheme to the players you have. And again, 9 tackles, 6 tackles for a loss, 3 sacks. Joseph Osai is a guy who is good enough to where you do tailor your entire scheme to maximize this guy's impact on the game. So, yeah, that's really all there is there.
I'm sure Tyler Huntley agrees.
Tyler Huntley, like, in the post-game presser was making all kinds of excuses, and I'm just going to chalk it up to him getting hit by Joseph Osai so many times that he didn't really know where he was. He thought he was on vacation with the beating he took at Osai's hands. Also important, the two senior wide receivers played their final game in burnt orange and had a good impact on the game. We didn't do a whole lot of passing. Only 12 completions for Sam, so there really wasn't a whole lot of yards to distribute there. But of those 201 yards that Sam had, 154 yards and 2 touchdowns, Devin Duvernay and Colin Johnson combining there. And I thought that was, it's really good, especially for Colin Johnson, a guy who's been hurt so much this year, getting to have an impact on the game. In his last hurrah,
yeah,
as a Texas
and impacting Longhorn early. I mean, first play of the game was a downfield shot for CJ. So definitely happy for him to be able to step up that way.
Yeah, and then I mean Devin just doing Devin Duvernay things like he's done all season.
Yeah, it was,
and especially with those two guys, I was concerned because other than that first throw, Sam for the entire first quarter was just off with everything. Mm-hmm. He was overthrowing guys left and right. But once he settled in there, I mean, those guys made their presence known for sure.
Yeah, and the thing I would add on Duvernay is that, like, his all three of his completions were, like, slot fades and corner routes. He had, like, one bubble screen that was called back because of holding. But that was really interesting to me that we definitely opened up a little bit more vertically than we have in the past and use that slot receiver downfield like a lot of other offenses are doing. Like anybody that watched the LSU-OU game knows that that slot fade can be killer in a modern offense. So I like that we ended the season with more of that.
Yep. And then you talked about winning all three phases of the game. DeShawn Jameson definitely had his impact on the game as the punt returner. Had the one really big punt return. It was like a 71-yarder to set up. I think it was our second touchdown.
It was the first touchdown. But, I mean, that changed the game.
That was the first touchdown. There you go. Yeah, and that's the impact that good special teams has, and that's why guys like Casey Horney and especially Derek Wareheim for us all year have been targets of so much hate, because that is something. I mean, it's one play where everything else sort of fades away, where you can change the momentum of a game with special teams. And a guy like DeShawn Jameson back there making that kind of play really sets the tone for everyone else.
And not to discredit DeShawn at all, but if you go back and look at it, the reason he had so much room to run is the guy on that side of the field that was responsible for contain just fell like about 5 yards in front of him getting to Jameson and trying to make the tackle. He just tripped on his own foot and fell over. So Jameson had a lot of running room, but I mean, he's fast. He showed it on the other punt return as well, where he picked up like 25 yards. He got downfield, put on a couple moves on the punter, and, you know, got it inside the 10. But he did have a little bit of help, and it's nice for us to not be the ones tripping over ourselves on special teams.
I mean, Derek Wareheim works in mysterious ways, just reaching out there, the invisible hand, just tripping up the defender and opening up a lane. So yeah,
and we did have the one muff punt, so Wareheim, you could definitely still see.
I know, Wareheim tried to even it out. It's like the force, it's just a never-ending balance here. Other guys who I thought had a big game, especially on the defensive side of the ball, I thought Caden Stearns looked a lot more like the Caden Stearns that we expected. He was doing good things coming downhill. Tyler Huntley's really not that big a passer, so Caden Stearns didn't really have the chance to make his presence known in the pass game as far as intercepting the ball or playing the ball there. But I thought as far as coming downhill and supporting the run and supporting those short throws that Utah was sort of trying to make their living on the majority of the game, I thought Caden Stearns looked a lot better than he has all year.
I thought this was Caden's best game of the season. I'm trying to think. Maybe like Iowa or Iowa State. I don't know. He definitely had a down year, at least like worse than what we were hoping for. He was battling injuries all year long, but I thought it was great to see him finally get healthy and actually play like the Caden that we grew to know and expect early on. So yeah, that was a big positive for me as well.
And then the next guy I kind of want to give a shout out to was the freshman, Chris Adimora. Doesn't really show up a ton on the stat sheet. I think he only ended up with one tackle and one pass defensed. But those the hits that he laid out and the pass that he got that he actually defended, I thought he flashed in the limited action that he got to see in this game. I thought he showed a lot of promise. I think he was the guy who got his head turned around and actually looked back for the ball on a deep throw. That is something that we have not seen from our secondary all year.
I definitely had some flashbacks while that throw was in the air. But he did a great job, so.
Yeah, I think he's got a lot of promise. And I'm hoping he's kind of like this year's Joseph Osai, who sort of has those flashes in the bowl game. Not to the same level. Osai was our leading tackler last year against Georgia. But being that freshman who sort of flashed in the bowl game and turns it into something big next season. Got a logjam of players in the secondary for next year, as we thought we had this year. But we'll see what he's able to get, how often he's able to get on the field next season.
Yep, definitely something to watch for. And hoping his development takes off, really, because we're going to need some of that. It's going to need to be better than what we saw this year.
For sure. The last guy that I want to give a shout-out to on this defense was not a guy who was actually on the field, was not suited up, was not wearing a helmet. But was, in fact, on the sidelines, the interim defensive coordinator, Craig Nivar. I thought, all things considered, I thought he did a great job. Seemed like he really simplified the defense without taking away any of the teeth. We didn't have any telegraphed blitzes that I can think of. We weren't sending anyone on a delayed blitz from 6 yards off the line of scrimmage. We were aggressive. We played pretty straightforward defense. You see what happens when you can just sort of allow yourself to lean on the athleticism of your players. You don't have to make things happen. You can let your players make them happen.
This is where I'll kind of chime in with something that might be an unpopular opinion. I don't know. But my one like thing where I'm like, whoa, like slow the reins there. Navar did a good job, but I mean, I really think that he just did like all the right things, if that makes sense. Like, I don't think there's anything special that he did. I think Todd Orlando probably would have been fine. Orlando never really struggled against traditional offenses. You can see USC the last 2 years, or like Kansas State, the couple times we've played them, whenever they've been more pro style. Like, we've always done well at Georgia last year. So, I mean, I do agree that he did a really good job, especially considering, you know, he was only our DC for 8 practices. He had to win over a locker room after their coach had been fired. And he had a lot of things to fix, probably just fundamentally. But yeah, generally, I just think that he didn't do anything special. He didn't overthink it, and that's kind of a step forward, sadly. But it's also something where I've seen some people be like, oh, maybe he should have been DC. And I'm like, well, let's slow it down there. He's called one game against a really limited offense. So, I'm impressed. I'm really happy with the way the defense played. But I don't think this is like we would have lost if Todd Orlando were still here sort of situation.
No, I don't think it would have been that bad. Like you said, not special, but with the way this defense, with the problems we had with this defense this year, just simply being solid was a vast improvement is enough reason to celebrate. I think this makes Tyler Huntley one of the few quarterbacks that we played this year that did not have a career day against us. So, I mean, for that reason, and it's because it's not like Tyler Huntley is the only limited quarterback that we played this year, especially with the arm. We played Max Duggan, we played Carter Stanley, we played Skylar Thompson, guys who are, Tyler Huntley for a while there was like a dark horse Heisman candidate, which I think was a bit of a stretch, but played guys who aren't going to be throwing it all over the yard on you, and these guys were putting up 250, 300 yards on us. I think Huntley got to like 160, 170 total yards passing, which is phenomenal against what's supposed to be the number 11 team in the country.
Yeah, and that is the sad truth, is that just almost addition by subtraction, just doing the basic things is an improvement. You know, as much as you and I have somewhat like lamented the Ash hire, that's really his MO, is the basics. So I hope that Ash will kind of be able to build on that, and maybe that's kind of a takeaway for him, is just keep on doing what was established in the last month and let that carry forward into next season.
Yeah, it definitely gives me a lot of confidence in Chris Ash's ability to come in. Yeah, just do basic things. Because we did, it did get noted to me on Twitter when I was sarcastically posting during the game, how did we lose to Iowa State, TCU, Baylor when the defense was playing like this? A lot of people were noting 4-man front, and we did do a lot of that. It wasn't exclusively 3-man fronts, using Osai effectively as a 4th man on the line, which is what Todd Orlando's base defense is supposed to do, where it's got the 3 guys and the B-backer to be your rush linebacker, which is what Osai should have been doing all year. You don't have to do a true 4-man front. You could have done Orlando's and gotten the same result. But even beyond that, I mean, we had instances where we had Malcolm Roach not with his hand in the dirt and still had 3 down linemen. So there is enough there to where you can see sort of that multiple look that gives me a lot of confidence that we can transition into whatever Chris Ash wants us to do.
Yeah, and I also think that a lot of people are like, see, Orlando, if you had just called basics, we would have gone 10-2 this year. But let's not forget that, in my opinion, we lost more games this year because of our offense than our defense. Which, I mean, part of that's because whenever our defense really struggled, we were still able to win with an elite offense. But if you go back and look at it, like, In our last 4 non-LSU losses, basically, we scored 27, 27, 21, 10. So the defense held up for parts of the year. I don't know. This is just still on that whole like Orlando tirade that I was kind of on, where it's, I don't think that this game should serve as like a point of revisionist history where we can just say, oh, if Orlando hadn't been here this year, we would have been so much better. This team had a lot of problems, and it's nice to see them fix many of them for the Utah game, but yeah, there's still a long ways to go for next year to really compete.
Yeah, and you mentioned a lot of people talking about, oh, Nivar should have just been our DC. Do we really need Chris Ash? I agree that one game isn't enough to say this guy is our DC, but I think for me, he shows enough value in that role to where I think we should definitely work to find a spot for him in Chris Ash's staff. I think that value, if he can remain even as co-DC to Chris Ash, I think that it makes me want Nivar to stick around next season. On the other side of the ball, Tim Beck got demoted, so Tom Herman was effectively operating as our offensive coordinator. And I think really the biggest thing that I got out of this, obviously didn't have any problem on offense, but the main thing was that we didn't let off the gas. Even once we got the lead, we kept pushing, we kept being aggressive, kept throwing down the field. Like the big throw to Devin Duvernay, I think we were up by 17, maybe 21 at that point, and we were still being aggressive going downfield. And that was refreshing for us not to sort of settle into that turtling mode where we just protect the lead. We were still being aggressive, still on the attack. I thought that was the biggest change that I saw by removing whatever input during the week Tim Beck had, because, I mean, as we've talked about and as every insider has said, Tom Herman's been the primary play caller basically since Maryland last season. So that didn't change, but our offensive game plan, I think, overall benefited by removing Tim Beck from the equation.
Yeah, I don't know how much Beck was actually still involved with the team. He's now OC at NC State, of course, but I don't know how much he did with game planning leading up to the game, so I don't know how much we can really look at him as a causative factor. But the thing that I will add is that I think that this kind of goes to show that Herman really is great with time to prepare. Like, we saw it last year with Georgia, where they did a lot of self-scouting, were able to hide a lot of tendencies, and really our offense last year was able to do the things they liked doing, but they were able to do it with different looks so that Georgia didn't know that it was coming. This year, I think it was Colin Johnson post-game talking about we ran a lot more bunch formations because they noticed on film that Utah would default to cover two or other coverages. Like, basically, they knew what Utah would do whenever they were going up against a bunch offense. So that's why, like, first snap of the game, you get Colin Johnson on a skinny post from a bunch formation, like, right in the smack dab of that cover two defense. So to me, the bigger takeaway about Herman having this time to prepare is that Herman still got it. I don't know what happened during the season, but like, he still got it. And I don't know why he was so not willing to change during the season to mix things up, because clearly he's willing to do it for the bowl game whenever he sees something in a defense. So I don't know if that speaks to our inability to properly scout our opponents during the season, or inability to properly scout ourselves, or just some sort of stubbornness that he was willing to go down with the ship and not change anything during the season. And maybe Beck was part of that. Maybe Beck is the conservative one. But yeah, I mean, Herman is still a good offensive mind. He still knows what he's doing. And whenever he has time to prepare, he's going to put together a good game plan. He just needs to do that more consistently on shorter timelines.
Yep. Like you said, he's still got it. But from all that, obviously a lot of good things to talk about with this Alamo Bowl. But I think there's really three things that really stood out. One of them we've already talked about, and we'll touch on it again. But what do you think the biggest things to take away? Who were the people that most impressed you? What things did we do that you thought were the most impressive in this Alamo Bowl?
Yeah, so for this part, I've kind of got three things that I took away that I actually think mean something for next season. Like, a lot of the stuff, like these bunch formations, I don't know if that actually means anything for next season, because it sounds like it was more just a situational thing against an opponent. Same thing with Court Jacques. Shout out to him, by the way, walk-on coming on, playing really well. I don't know what that means for next season. Like, maybe he gets in the linebacker rotation, maybe he doesn't. But three things that I took away that I liked that I do think will translate to the future. First off was Keontae Ingram. I thought he was great. I think that this is a continuation of his improvement over the course of the season. And I think he also got to be more consistent over the course of the season. So I think that if he can just keep that up, and if we're able to limit his carries, we should have the sufficient depth to do that. Keep him on like a 12-ish carry count, you know, like a, or maybe a 15 touch count if you want to throw in receptions and stuff. I think we can see more of this Keontae next year. Second, I had BJ Foster, just because he was back at a traditional safety spot with Brandon Jones out. And I kind of mentioned it in one of our episodes talking about the Ash hire, that I don't know how well we're going to be able to fill the second spot next to Stearns. But it was nice to see Foster play well from that traditional deep safety spot. And then third, we talked about it a lot already, but Osai actually playing on the line was so refreshing to see, and for him to do all game long basically was great. Like even during the season, he was still dropping into coverage this game. So it's not like he was doing anything totally different. It's just all about his alignment. Because anytime he would rush the passer from Rover, you're asking him to do it like 3 yards off the line, 4 yards off the line. From Nickel, he might have been 6 yards off the line. But it's put him on the line of scrimmage, let him do the same stuff, and he's going to be great for us.
And I think the guy who was most excited about watching Joseph Osai just sort of wreak havoc was Charles Omenihu. Could not stop posting on Twitter about how good Joseph Osai was, how happy he was that we were finally letting him just basically act as a pure rush the passer role.
Yeah. Omenihu was probably a little jealous.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and Omenihu even talked about it during the season. One of his complaints was he's like, let Joseph Osai rush the passer.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, I think there was a game where Joseph Osai had a good game, and Charles Omenihu was still like, it'll be even better if he rushes the passer. And here you go. You get the payoff there. You mentioned Keyonte Ingram. I honestly thought about when they announced that Sam Ehlinger was the offensive MVP. Obviously, I'm not going to be upset about Sam getting recognition, but I thought there was an argument to be made that Keyonte Ingram might have even been our actual offensive MVP. Not that Sam didn't do some good things, but I think Keyonte was really the guy for the offense. He's really the one who set the tone, I thought, for the offense overall. But yeah, all in all, a good way to close out the season. Makes it now for the end of the season for both of the big two sports, ending up as champions. I mean, Alamo Bowl champions, NIT champions. Doesn't get much better than that, does it?
That is exactly what we wanted going into this year. So yeah, it definitely doesn't get any better. Not for UT fans this decade, but, you know, 2010s are over, so Natty, here we come.
Yeah, new decade, new us, hopefully. And hopefully no more of these stupid letdown games. But a guy who's going to have a big impact on whether or not we have any letdown games finally made our hire for the new offensive coordinator, Mike Yurcich. He was the former QB coach and passing game coordinator at Ohio State. Really former, he was only there for a year. But after the year that we saw Justin Fields have, that's a lot of reason to get excited, because Mike Yurcich, not just at Ohio State, but before that when he was at Oklahoma State, basically has 8 or 9 consecutive years with several different quarterbacks, all who are able to produce at an extremely high rate and not just exclusively playing in an air raid like you think of when you think Mike Gundy. There are a lot of good things that he did as a QB developer, and as far as the offenses that we've seen him coach and be a part of. So I think this is an exciting hire. I know it's not the big flashy name when Graham Harrell's name and Joe Brady's name was being thrown around, but I have a lot of good feelings here. But the thing that gives me the best feeling was Longhorn Frenzy posting the screenshots from Buck Nuts and every other Ohio State message board of Buckeye fans just absolutely melting down about the timing of our announcement, with Brett McMurphy announcing that Yurcich was expected to be our offensive coordinator 2 days before their playoff game. At this point, there's not an online fan base I loathe more than the Buckeyes, even more than Texas A&M, more than Sooners. Buckeyes right now, man, whenever I can get a taste of their tears, nothing tastes sweeter to me.
I agree, because we interact with A&M and OU fans a lot more. But man, do I not like the worst fan base in college football, the Ohio State Buckeyes. But yeah, it's amazing what being accused of leaking information about a domestic abuser will do to your reputation in the state of Ohio. They do not like Tom Herman.
The fact that you would support someone who is a victim of domestic violence makes you public enemy number one.
Yeah, they're blood boiling.
Yeah, I mean, the only thing that I'm really sad about is that we still have another, 6-7 years before we get to play Ohio State. So I'm hoping we keep this level of vitriol up, because, I mean, like, the LSU game was fun because I thought the LSU fans in person were a ton of fun. The tailgating was a ton of fun. When Ohio State comes to town, if this level of hatred between our two fan bases keeps up, that one could get bloody. That one's going to be fun for an entirely different reason.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, on Yurcich, I'm a big fan of the hire. Once it became clear that Herman wanted somebody that would run, quote-unquote, his offense, Yurcich was my number one guy. I guess like Lashley and the guy from Minnesota, whose name I don't want to try to pronounce, were like some of the other rumored names. But Yuricich I like because he has a pretty like varied background. He's run a lot of different stuff in the past. He isn't just tied to a certain scheme or a certain personnel package. So I like that about him. But, you know, ultimately the question will be how much control he'll have over the offense and how much Herman is willing to let him deviate from that 11 personnel pro spread that he seems to really be married to.
Yeah, if nothing else, I think probably the thing that makes a lot of people nervous, and probably the same people who are nervous about Graham Harrell, is they know Yuricich's background at Oklahoma State under Gundy. So there's a lot of this sort of interpretation of that meaning that Yuricich is an air raid type of guy. You go back and look at what Oklahoma State did while he was there, the little bit of time he had at Ohio State, the little bit of time he even spent as a high school coach, you see that there are still quite a few power run concepts that are part of the playbook that he's been a part of at each of those levels, at each of those stops. So, I mean, at absolute worst with the air raid stuff, you're going to bring in some of those principles, but for the most part, he does sort of fit what we want to do. Be able to run the ball, a lot of reads, read options, power reads, where I think it fits what we have now, and it'll fit nicely with Herman, and he does have that ability to be autonomous as far as play calling. He doesn't need Herman in his ear every single play like Tim Beck did. Yuricich is going to be able to do that for himself.
Mm-hmm. And then we'll be able to really see if there's that much of a difference from Herman, you know, because he's saying, oh, I need to be more of a CEO. I need to be able to make sure the entire team is developing. So we're really going to see if that's true.
Yeah. As far as the rest of the coaching staff, we're still supposedly expecting more changes beyond just guys being added for the holes. Obviously, Tim Beck being gone, Drew Merringer being gone, Corby Meekins being gone. We replaced Tim Beck with Yuricich. Todd Orlando leaving obviously got replaced by Chris Ash. But we do right now still have two openings on the staff and possibly then some if there are more changes coming, like, fingers crossed, Derek Wareheim, guys like Casey Horney. If the guys like that end up being scarce in Austin next season, there's going to be quite a few things to turn over. So right now on defense, Chris Ash is the defensive coordinator. We still have Nivar, still have Jason Washington, and still have... I just totally forgot Giles' first name. Oscar Giles, that's it. Still have Oscar Giles. A lot of those guys, like I said, after this bowl game, I'm hoping Nivar sticks around. I think Giles, we all expected to stick around. But the thing I think that makes it interesting, especially for Nivar in Washington, is that Chris Ash's background, even as a defensive coordinator, is he has always sort of specialized in the secondary. He's not like Todd Orlando, where he was the DC and the linebacking coach. So it'll be interesting to see how that sort of shakes out, if that ends up squeezing one of Nivar or Washington out or moving them to another position. I don't know the background for Nivar or Washington, if they are a guy who can slide in at linebacker. But Herman has talked about wanting to balance the staff, so that means we're for sure going to get at least one other defensive coach in here. And I think a lot of us are hoping that means Oscar Giles is going to be the defensive ends coach, get a guy to be the defensive tackle coach. I think that's the first change that we're looking for, possibly a second one, depending on whether or not Nivar or Washington gets squeezed out.
Yeah, that's pretty standard for staffs that are, you know, sensibly staffed with five guys on defense and five guys on offense, you know, common sense sort of things. But yeah, usually there's two defensive line coaches. So I do think that's where we're headed. And interestingly, I actually have been looking at Navar's background, and he has coached defensive line before. Safety, defensive line, and special teams sort of seems to be his thing. So I think that he's the guy that's most likely to get pushed out. I expect either one of him or Washington to end up getting kind of shoved out to make room for Ash in the secondary. But moving Navar to defensive line is kind of an intriguing option. And also letting him take back control of special teams. I think he's done that for us previously. So I'm not necessarily advocating for that. I think there are a lot of really good defensive line coaches out there that we could grab. But that is something just to kind of keep on the back of your mind.
Yeah, I mean, if Nivar is the guy that can be manipulated, if he slots in even at linebacker, and we have a defensive line guy come in, I know I think as far as I'm concerned, my personal wish list of what I think is actually achievable, I think the number one name I'd be looking for, if we're looking for a defensive tackles coach, is going up the road to Waco and getting Franco Cam. But otherwise, I mean, that'll be one that we'll be waiting to see what happens there. On the offensive side of the ball, obviously, got Yurcich in as the offensive coordinator. Stan Drayton's still there, running back. Herb Hand is still there for offensive line. He had a real good time during the pre-Alamo Bowl press conferences, advocating for Devin Duvernay. Talked about how it was basically a shame and a joke that Devin Duvernay was not considered for any postseason awards, the Biletnikoff especially. So, I mean, Hand is a guy I think that a lot of us want to see stick around, just because he seems to get the offensive line going the right direction, and is a good recruiter. And then, unfortunately, Derek Wareheim's still around. No guarantees that he's gone, but if there are any other coaches going, other than squeezing out Nivar in Washington, it seems like Wareheim would be the next most obvious candidate to get cut loose. So, at a minimum, we need a wide receiver coach. We do not have anyone currently coaching wide receivers. And with Yurcich, there's been a lot of names rumored. Heard everything from Emmett Jones from Kansas, spent a lot of time at Texas Tech, as well as down in Houston. We have former Houston receiver Tyron Carrier. I think both of those guys would be pretty good. Carrier, I think, would be especially critical because one of the issues that we had with Maringer and with Meekins was really their inability to sort of connect with their players. If you got a guy like Tyron Carrier, Carrier is in his early 30s, played high school football in Texas, played at Houston, so he's familiar with Texas. That's a guy who's going to be able to communicate with our receivers now, more closely identify, for no other reason than just like age alone. Not that Maringer was old, but he'll feel more connection to his players, having played the position not that long ago. So I think Carrier would be good. And then Emmett Jones's real impact, I think, not just as a good wide receiver coach, but he's known as a rainmaker recruiter, especially in DFW, which is an area that we have not really secured as well as I think Herman would have hoped. So I think that would be another great option at wide receiver as well. And then if Derek Wareheim does end up leaving, that opens up the tight end spot. I don't know, for tight end coaches, that's a whole nother ball game that I haven't gotten into. And I'm not sure if those two guys, between Carrier and Jones, if that could be manipulated into both of them showing up. Who knows?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I'm an Emmett Jones fan, personally. But, I mean, he or Carrier would both be fine. And really, just having a wide receiver coach that isn't horrible will be an upgrade. So I'm excited to see what our what our wideouts can do, because they've been good the last couple of years, but I'm excited to see what they can do with like a real coach.
I mean, at this point, I'll take just getting through a season without having it seem like half the wide receiver room is going to transfer before the next game. That alone will be a monster improvement compared to Maringer.
Yeah, and I feel like this is an appropriate time just to mention that Drew Maringer somehow landed a co-OC / wide receiver coach gig at FAU.
I mean, it seems like everywhere that Lane Kiffin has been now at this point is just in absolute shambles. Tennessee might have figured some things out finally years after Lane Kiffin was gone. USC, we see all the problems with Clay Helton. We have benefited from the problems that they're having and continue to have there. FAU inexplicably hiring Maringer as co-offensive coordinator. And then the Lane train pulls into Oxford, Mississippi, and hires DJ Durkin as their defensive coordinator at Ole Miss, which is, I mean, pathetic. This guy is 2 years removed from having literally had one of his players die because of all of the issues that him and his coaching staff created as a culture at Maryland. And Lane Kiffin, apparently, and Ole Miss especially, could not care less. And it's one of those things that sort of permeates a lot of those, especially the lower tier SEC schools, is that they are willing to overlook stuff that's that blatant. Because he's also got Briles with him. He had Briles at FAU, and then Briles went to Florida State, but he had Kendall Briles. I don't know if it's just a Lane Kiffin problem. It's a thing that seems to pop up in the SEC a lot, where they're willing to overlook these issues. But Lane Kiffin especially has a knack for just picking the worst people to be on his coaching staffs.
Yeah, it's pretty, I mean, some people might call it disappointing. I kind of think it's just disgusting to hire guys like that in charge of 18 to 22 year olds. But I was on the Lane meme train, but then, yeah, not anymore after Durkin.
Yeah, Lane's good for Twitter, and otherwise, I think you should really not use him as a guide for anything. All right, so kind of bring this to the end there. I guess we can talk a little bit, with this being the end of the season, kind of what our off-season plans are. I don't know if you want to get into personal off-season plans, but at least as far as the podcast is concerned, previously our goal during the off-season is to produce one episode per month. During the season, obviously one per week because we've got a game just about every single week. There's always something to talk about. With the coaching staff search, with National Signing Day 2 coming in February, our goal is to be at about one per month. So I'm sure later this month we'll have stuff to talk about with the coaching staff. I imagine that'll all be basically ironed out before we get to National Signing Day 2. So that'll probably be the big January episode, considering this is sort of the bookend for the season. Got that big January episode. February, you'll be talking National Signing Day. March and April will have sort of bookends for the spring practice. And then from there, we get into the heart, the off season in May, June, July, before we kick back off with fall practice. So there in the middle, we're going to see what news stories come out. It's probably going to be talking about dumb things happening in the recruiting for the 2021 class. Who knows? But this program has a way of finding news to talk about, it seems like, every single month.
Yeah, we'll have to see who next year's Brew McCoy is, and we'll keep all of our listeners up to date on those sorts of situations, those brew ha-has that might come up during the spring.
Yep, and, I mean, we've got a little Discord chat that we personally use with some friends that seems to have a knack for memeing things into existence. So we'll be working hard on that, especially before National Signing Day 2. Hopefully we can meme Kelly Ringo into somehow joining the 2020 class. But otherwise, as far as off the podcast, we're going to try and do what we did last year. It was a lot of work to do it on Twitter, but it's something that we thought was fun, thought it was good for engagement, thought it was good for getting the podcast's name out there. Was doing our top 25 plays countdown, where we go through and make streamables of every single play and then count down for 25 weeks up to kickoff. So that's something that we want to do again this year. I don't know when we need to actually start posting those, but I would definitely encourage you guys to keep up with us on Twitter. If you guys are from Reddit, definitely keep an eye out for where Noah and I are posting, because hopefully on Longhorn Nation, we'll do what we did again, where we'll have people vote for their favorite plays, come up with the list of the top 25, and go from there, because that's something we're going to have to get started on here pretty soon. If there is anything that you guys want to see us do, definitely let us know, whether it's on Reddit, whether it's on Twitter, if it's in the comments on any of the whatever platform you're listening on, if it's on iTunes, Spotify, if you're listening straight on Podbean, wherever you're listening to Hornscast, some comments on what you want to see through the off season. We've got a few ideas, but obviously more engagement with the audience is better, I figure, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And as always, people can call into our hotline, whose number I do not know, but
whose number I should totally have memorized, but I don't have memorized.
Yeah, if anybody wants to call in, just stalling. Text, give us a voicemail. We listen to all of those. So if anybody wants to, you know, give us your thoughts on the season, kind of a final review. If anybody wants to give us their grades for the season, we'll probably do some sort of final review episode at some point, I'm sure, where we kind of do some grading and big picture look at the season. Spoiler alert, I'm giving
a D minus. By the way, that phone number, you're giving a D minus. That phone number for the hotline, text or leave a voicemail. Again, I don't want to pick up the phone either, so it will send you straight to voicemail if you call. 512-655-9038 for the Fire Tom Herman podcast hot take line. Yeah, text or call, but that's another way to get in touch with us this offseason. But other than that, thank you for joining us for another season of the podcast. We wish the football season had gone a little bit better, obviously, but we still had fun putting these together outside of some of the more brutal losses where it was kind of a beating to have to circle back and talk about them. But still, I thought overall it was a good season for the podcast.
Yeah, it was my first season on the pod. I had a good time. Some of the rewatches were painful, but but you know, it was fun.
Yeah, and it feels like we've grown a lot. I'm sure if we compare this episode to the first couple episodes that Noah was on, I'm sure we've seen a lot of things get smoothed out that might have been issues back then. So, yeah, it's been a good, successful podcasting season. Maybe not a successful football season. But also our first year on Hornscast, so definitely enjoying being a part of the network with 4th and 5, Pretend We're Football, whenever BC Unplugged remembers to record and release an episode. All that's entertaining. Glad to be a part of it. Hopefully, Baser will have us around next season as well. I don't have any reason to believe he wouldn't, but I haven't actually talked to him about it, so we'll see. But we appreciate all the support, all the new audience we've seen this year. And again, make sure to follow us through the offseason, especially for that top 25 countdown, because we'll also tweet it out when we post the Reddit thread where we'll have everyone vote. So follow us on Twitter at the FTH Podcast if you want to be a part of that. Any recruiting shit posts or just shit posting about anything. If I'm talking shit about Mike Leach for making fun of Landon Jackson's drills at the All-American stuff, we'll be doing all that on Twitter pretty consistently. But not sure when it's going to be quite yet, but we will see y'all on our next episode. Hook 'em.